All right, guys, and welcome back to another edition of the Newly Meds podcast. Today we have a returning guest for back-to-back episodes here, and we've brought back Matt Myers, the EMS physician, paramedic, and EMT before all that started out in fire. And we have a really unique case. We do this a lot on the Newly Meds podcast. Is we look at different cases, we break it down, and we sort of revisit some clinical pearls and some key treatments that we would do in the pre-hospital setting. So today we're going to be looking at an 83-year-old male found unresponsive, and there were some pretty key findings here. So Matt, why don't you walk us through this case a little bit? Like I said, 83-year-old male, unresponsive. If we're going off our dispatch information, we don't have a ton. What are you thinking about here? And sort of open the door for us. You walk in. What's this patient looking like for you?
Yeah, so this one actually happened back when I was in residency, riding on one of the trucks. We were like 20 minutes away. It was one of those nice, busy days of EMS. You know, you can't get this call where you're 5 minutes away. You got to be 20 minutes away. So fire somehow got dispatched for this prior to it, but you were dispatched for an unresponsive person, and that was kind of all the information with abnormal breathing, your normal pro QA questions that you get. So we showed up. Fire had this guy already outside of the house on just kind of on the grass. I think it was a warmer day. I don't remember what time of the season it was, but he really wasn't doing anything. Had some nice shallow respirations, really wasn't opening up his eyes at all. Was really cachectic peering as well. It sounds like from the inside of the house, it was just kind of like hoarding conditions. And there he was on the ground. So,
right. So we see a patient on the ground and looks like he's not breathing well. He's unresponsive, really hard to arouse. What are some immediate things that you want to do? And looks like we obtained a vital set here, so I'll run through that with you. You've got a pulse of 74, a BP of 148 over 100. Respirations were 24 with no detectable pulse ox. Sounds like he's not moving air well, so he's a little bit on the tachypneic side, but as far as the volume of air moving, he's shallow, obviously unresponsive. The other pertinent findings here was he had a Foley catheter in, and here it says it doesn't really look like that Foley's doing too hot. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that? You did a visual exam. We've got a vital set. Hooking him up to the monitor. What are some things that you found on this call?
Yeah, so he didn't really weigh much, and the truck was right next to him, so we kind of just put him on the stretcher and moved him to the back of the truck. Yeah, and got those vital signs there. As soon as he was in the back of the truck, I mean, you're going through your ABCs like you should in the beginning. One of us started to bag the patient at that time. Really wasn't getting great end titles with the BVM, so it kind of repositioned a little bit, started to get some end titles with that as well that were better, but his SpO2 just wasn't really registering also, so probably wasn't perfusing that well if your pulse ox isn't picking up things. So then, you know, it's that unresponsive patient that you kind of just go through your rapid trauma exam. You don't know how they got on the ground, potentially really what things looked like per se as well, and he's got a Foley catheter in and didn't look that great. But then when you kind of look a little bit closer too at his abdomen, like his suprapubic region, it almost looks like a mass in there, so not really draining the urine as well. And that kind of was the hallmark finding on exam that led to everything else. So we got a sugar at some point in there too early on in the beginning. I think that was normal. But so there's that. Pupils look fine as well. Think about your altered mental status things. And he's actually tachypneic, not bradypneic. So naloxone's probably not going to work. So you're kind of, you've cleaned out your altered mental status, quick fix toolbox for the pre-hospital environment with that. So we got this EKG on him. Wasn't really that impressed by it when I looked at it the first time. Looked like there might have been a right bundle branch block on it. Sure, maybe some peak T waves that I didn't really appreciate at that point with it. And there's this first degree AV block. So I really didn't know what this was. He's got a Foley catheter in two to begin with. What else is going on it? And then another thing I didn't see until we were probably a few more minutes as things progressed was this left anterior fascicular block as well, which we can talk about that a little bit more too.
Yeah, so one of the key things that you mentioned here in the 12 lead, and I think that this is something that there's a vast array as the paramedics in the field are. We deal a ton with cardiology, and you know that as a physician as well. We're obtaining 12 leads on a large number of patients in the hospital, but especially in the pre-hospital setting, it's one of our largest diagnostic tools, right? We don't have imaging. We don't have labs. I can't see through people. I'm not an X-ray or a CT or an MRI. So I put a 12 lead on, and I'm going to be able to obtain, if I know how to interpret it really well, a lot of information. So sort of to walk our viewers through this 12 lead, and we'll upload an attachment of it in the show notes. We're seeing a little bit of ST depression in the precordials, maybe some peak T waves. We're a little bit wide, but like you said, maybe a right bundle branch block, nothing super appreciable. You're seeing a first degree AV block, and then you're looking a little closer and you see this thing that, when I talk to a lot of medics, is like the world's biggest mystery. What the heck is an LAFB, or left anterior vesicular block? So when we think about cardiac fascicles, and we're thinking about really any type of block, there's some sort of conduction delay somewhere in our system. And here we're talking about it, again, in the fascicles, a block. How do we find that on a 12 lead? And why is it so important as we progress through this call?
So as far as things for my mind, because I think very simply, I need it to be simple. I can't go into this like very long, well, there's a slight slur to this thing and that makes it that. The easiest way for your fascicular blocks, you have your anterior and posterior fascicular blocks. So the easiest place to look at this is you're looking at leads 1 and AVL, and then you're looking at the inferior leads 2, 3, AVF. So in order to meet the criteria for the left anterior fascicular block, you need to have the majority of your deflection for your QRS in 1 and AVL have to be up, and it has to be up in both. And then when you go to your inferior leads, you're looking at that same QRS deflection, and they have to be down in all three leads, the majority of it is. If one of those leads doesn't completely meet that criteria for it, you don't have it. It has to meet the criteria for all of it. So every QRS has to be completely down in the inferior leads. Every QRS in 1 AVL has to be up. And then the opposite would be your posterior fascicular block. So if 1 AVL, it's all, your QRS is all down, and then 2, 3 AVF, it's all up, then you have the posterior fascicular block for it. And it's not important as much of knowing exactly where that is or what that's located in it, but the bigger thing is that it's another block in the electrical conduction system. And that stuff plays more into a patient with syncope that wants to refuse care. So if you have a bundle branch block or an AV block, fascicular block is just as important in the grand scheme of things with those. So a patient with new syncope who has two types of blocks, so whether it's an AV block, a bundle branch block, or a fascicular block, and you don't have a previous EKG to compare to, they're at high risk that they actually had a true cardiac cause to their syncope itself, especially in an elderly patient too, or someone over that age of 40, or even 50. They should definitely go to the hospital, get evaluated, because they potentially need a pacemaker. You might get them there and they've already had this bifascicular block and it's nothing new, but at that time, in that moment, you can't really make that decision. Like, this is the one that you really want to catch.
Thinking about treating everything that we find in the pre-hospital setting acutely. If we're seeing any cardiac finding, we don't have prior EKGs to compare it off of. We can't have the luxury of being in a hospital and pulling up that patient's chart and being like, ah, oh, this is something that, you know, Larry Joe had 45 years ago. It's nothing new. We have to treat it as an acute finding. So we're looking at this 12 lead here. We've got a first degree AV block. There's a right bundle branch block and a fascicular block. So we're looking at a bifascicular block. Borderline here, if the AV block got any higher, it would be a trifascicular block. So we're definitely concerned now that this is a fairly serious cardiac patient, syncope, unresponsive, unarousable. Let's progress through this call a little bit. What started to happen? Because one thing that I noticed here as we were working through this call is a rapid change. I don't want to get too far into that, but you're looking at the 12 lead and you're like, something's not right. And then maybe you look back down at your patient that's either, you know, in the truck right now or still on the grass if you didn't move them, and you're like, huh, something's now really not right.
So GCS was obviously less than 8. We were providing respiratory support as well with a BVM. We wanted to intubate this patient. Didn't have great vasculature to begin with, so successfully placed an IO, and then we kind of had a lower blood pressure down in the 70s, over 30s, you know, doing your best to try to get as much fluid through an IO as possible without making your saline bag explode. So I'd made the decision at that point just to give 20 micrograms of push dose epi as well, which didn't really help us at that point. It was kind of like a Hail Mary to get fluids in. This patient's obviously more intravascularly depleted than everything. Our initial plan was we were going to use etomidate to facilitate intubation. It was probably going to need an even lower dose than what you typically would do at your 0.3 milligrams per kilogram. But in the meantime, we lost pulses and started to do some CPR.
Right. So a pretty rapid decline from our patient here. And so the one thing that I want to hit on really hard is you originally found this patient and, again, not appearing visually well, but as far as vitals go, you do have a palpable pulse. It's at a normal sinus or a normal rate. I don't want to say a normal sinus rate, but it's at a normal rate. Blood pressure is actually not that bad. We're a little on the hypertensive side, but, you know, nothing appreciable out of the blood pressure. They're not hypotensive. Respirations are tachypneic. Pupils look good. They're just not moving a bunch of air. So you suction, you bag them, you get a 12 lead. 12 lead starts to look funky. We go through. Now they're hypotensive. GCS originally, you know, less than 8. You're thinking about taking an airway. Now all of a sudden, patient loses a pulse. And you look back to your monitor and you start to see something that's a little more funky. And now you sort of have this knowledge base that, oh, now this all makes sense. So walk us through what you see on the monitor.
Yeah, so look at your telemetry strip on there. It was nice to have that 12 lead to begin with. Even if you had a rhythm strip to begin with before, you could at least see the sizes of your QRS complexes. I feel like a lot of what we talk about now with kind of ACLS going down the road and how things change for your PEA approaches, are the complexes wide or are they narrow? And you kind of have a different approach to that also with it. So we got these really wide complexes that kind of looks like a VTAC, but not like what you would think of VTAC, and this rate's definitely really slow. So that was probably about the time when all the pieces kind of clicked together, and I was like, ooh, Foley catheter not draining, arrest, slow heart rate. Oh boy, this is sine waves. This is hyperkalemia. And that's what that bundle branch block was in there. Because if you look at that first 12 lead on it, it kind of looks like a bundle branch block, but not exactly as much of how you classically see the bundle branch block itself. And then if you start to look at the T waves a little bit, you're like, eh, they do look a little peaked too. And then you can start to get those AV blocks as well. Because remember, later down the road in your hyperkalemia pathway, you start to get widening of that PR interval longer, and then you eventually just lose your P wave as well. So it quickly fell off the cliff here. So that kind of was the hallmark of, I need to give some calcium here and do some other things.
Yeah, I think you hit a really good note there. And the one thing that I always find really fascinating with cardiology, but especially with our potassium changes on an EKG, is we can't get labs pre-hospitally, but what we can do is get a really good analysis of a 12 lead. A lot of electrolyte changes we're going to see have some sort of, depending on how far advanced they are, physiological change, and we're going to be able to identify that. So we talk about it a lot. If they're hypokalemic, maybe some flatter T waves or the absence of T waves could be a little on the bradycardic side. And then when we get hyperkalemic, start to get a little wide. Originally, we were actually just getting the peak T waves, taller T waves. And it's really cool when we think about the progression, right? We get tall T waves, then we widen. And now all of a sudden, am I about to shock this patient? Because they're in VTAC. And it's because we have that sine wave. And it's really cool when we look at literature that you can almost pinpoint someone's their serum potassium level based off of an EKG finding. So we look at this patient and you say here he's got creatinine greater than 12, his potassium's 8.8. So some poor renal function and a super high potassium. So that all makes sense with what you're doing. So now you're like, I need calcium. Why is that? What are we going to do now that we see this wide complex tachyarrhythmia? He's pulseless in arrest. Walk us through your treatment and how it sort of differs from what we talked about earlier, right? ACLS says one thing on how to manage the arrest, and now we're sort of in a different situation. It's a witnessed arrest, and our treatment plan is going to be more tailored to this specific patient.
Yeah, so if you look at the kind of the pieces of the puzzle here for this guy, renal failure in general, hyperkalemia. So this hyperkalemia was precipitated by renal failure. You can break renal failure up into pre-renal, intrarenal, post-renal. So pre-renal is normally your stuff that you're getting, primarily dehydration, not eating, drinking. Intrarenal is normally comes from a bazillion different things that isn't too acute for us. That's normally some more stuff that's found throughout a hospital stay itself. And then post-renal is normally some type of obstruction past the kidneys itself, where you're making urine, but you're not physically able to get the urine out. So in this case, this was a post-renal syndrome because his Foley catheter was blocked up. That suprapubic mass that was there, that bladder all distended from it. So it's able to make the urine, but not able to get the urine out. So that's just backing up onto the kidneys, and your kidneys are responsible for clearing the potassium. Some other key context for this was we had no clue how long this guy was in the house. The last time we checked on him was days itself, too. So you have a lot of time for that to really build up. So it looks like VTAC. Do you shock it? Do you not shock it? Sure, shock it. Is it going to do anything? Probably not at the end of the day, because it's this electrolyte abnormality. First-line drug that you should use if you really suspect hyperkalemia is going to be calcium. Calcium is the most important one to do. Calcium does absolutely nothing to shift potassium around, but it helps to stabilize the myocardium, which is how you're going to end up hopefully getting them back into a more perfusing rhythm at the end of the day with things. Remember, that only lasts about 30 to 60 minutes, so you're probably going to have to redose it. I think one of the disservices we kind of do is we only have, 1 gram of calcium chloride almost on every truck. Some places occasionally have 2, but it's not commonly used at all. So if this was, a patient with a crush injury in a vehicle accident with it who was prolonged, or, say, on a hike that had a tree fall on them and it's been on them for days, you want to move them. Before you start to do any of that moving and thinking about it, give the calcium, but, make sure you have more calcium coming on the way, because if your next help's 20, 30 minutes out and you need more calcium, guess what? You're kind of up the creek without a paddle at that point and need to do a little bit more.
So we progress. You shock them once. It's wide. They're in arrest. Looks like VTAC. Sine waves, but more than appropriate to shock. Will it change? No. But you give the calcium. So you're on scene. You're seeing this. And finally, Matt, you're it clicked. I know where we're at. So I'm going to give the calcium. What happens after you give the calcium? What other things are you going to want to do and why? And then walk us through what else you want to do. So we were talking about intubating this patient. Did we? Why did we? Obviously, we're in arrest now. And what other medications do we need to get on board? Probably before we get the epi on board for arrest or other medications that we might think about in ACLS, because we need to tailor what now we are highly suspicious of, and that's hyperkalemia. And we talk about that being from a number of things, right? We talked about rhabdo in a prior episode. You just talked about crush injury. We can see it in our renal patients. I mean, there's no shortage of things that can cause someone's potassium to jack up, and they tend to deteriorate fairly fast. So when you get suspicious of it, how do you tailor your treatment plan toward those patients?
So, I mean, that next EKG you had, you can see the calcium did something. We're no longer in a sine wave. It's still wide. It's not great, but, and then post-shock, we really didn't have any change with it as well, which makes me think a little bit more along that line. So pre-hospital wise, a little bit limited as far as what do we do as far as shifting ions around and kind of moving things. Your biggest bang for your buck that you're going to have in your toolbox is going to be sodium bicarbonate. Again, it doesn't really do too much. You might get a shift about anywhere from 0.1 to 0.3 milliequivalents, but it's something that you have that you can do. So renal failure, kind of going down the whole bicarb, not bicarb approach to things. A lot of this kind of how you tailor bicarb or not is based off their overall pH in general and urine production too, which is not something we're really going to see a lot of or do, but acidosis is going to worsen renal failure too at the end of the day. A bicarb drip is going to work a lot better than doing bicarb pushes. Bicarb pushes is real temporary and kind of goes away. You need more of a bicarb drip at the end of the day for renal failure. And there's way more education and stuff to learn about bicarb drips. That's way too long to go over for this currently, but there's lots of stuff to get in the weeds with that. Your other choice you really have in the field would be albuterol as well. Sure, go ahead and try it to make it look like you did the thing. It's probably not going to do anything. You need to be on continuous, hour-long treatments itself to really try to get any potassium itself to shift in general. One thing I'll say with this too, so your dialysis patients are the ones we're probably more frequently acquainted with as far as hyperkalemia. depending upon how long they've been on dialysis or kind of had their chronic renal failure, their body becomes a little bit more susceptible to higher levels of potassium. So you're not going to see, I've had people in the ER a lots of times with potassiums up in the 7s, 8s that have still normal EKGs itself. People who are more naive to kind of chronic kidney diseases, you're going to see the more rapid progression, kind of like this guy was himself, where he's not dialysis, just has this Foley that ends up getting blocked. But I think stuff to remember too with calcium and when to give it. Guidelines say just peak T waves is not enough to treat with calcium itself. You need to have like widening of your QRS as well with it. So that's a thing to remember too from the pre-hospital environment. Like, yeah, you might see peak T waves and call in and be like, I want to give calcium. There's this going on, but you're not going to get orders for it most likely. You need to have more of that progression to it. And then you can see as you start to treat it, as the worse the hyperkalemia gets, it's kind of like a string pulling out until it gets completely flat, and you hope you never get to that flat portion of it. But then as you start to fix it, your string starts to come back and starts to look more like things you are familiar with.
So when we think about giving calcium, you provide a unique perspective here because you were on this call in the pre-hospital environment, but you also have some really great insight for the hospital. And we talked about it earlier that there's some steps that you would take in the hospital. We talked about it a little bit, saying how we can give some albuterol, but they're going to need to be on a pretty continuous neb for a few hours. If you carry terbutaline, probably not a bad idea. Again, we were talking about those beta agonists trying to encourage that potassium to get out of the cell and get some ion movement. Bicarb as well. What are some other things that you would do in the hospital? And then how can we prepare, because in the pre-hospital setting, we want to prepare our patients to have the best outcome in the hospital. We can do a lot in the field, but ultimately we're transporting those patients to definitive care, which is the hospital. So how can we best tailor a patient like this, say if you weren't on scene as an EMS physician and things weren't getting done, calling command, you know, stating our suspicions here for hyperkalemia, what's the best thing to do to get our patient in a position for the hospital to take care of them? And what would the hospital do? What are some medications that you would want to get on board fairly fast with our renally impaired patients or our kidney patients that are now hyperkalemic?
Yeah, I think you kind of break that down to, are we still in cardiac arrest or are we now ROSC with everything? So if this is still cardiac arrest going on, I'm going to give more calcium too. I already had a response to it. I want to get this better, especially with the story that I have going on with it. So this might be that time too where hopefully you have the second medic show up for the cardiac arrest or called for help, because you're going to steal their calcium too and try to give that. Big things to kind of get is try to get vascular access as much as you can. If you can secure an airway as well and start to kind of help correct that underlying acidosis as well by ventilating and getting out some CO2, you might start to help kind of fix a little bit of that acidosis as well that you were kind of going with your bicarb, and maybe perk up the kidneys a little bit to do something. Foley catheters, right? No one carries Foley catheters on their truck. I remember when I went through, we learned Foley catheters, and I put plenty of them in Presby's and Mercy's ER out in Pittsburgh. And yeah, but I don't know if that's still within our scope of practice of everything. But I mean, if you had a Foley catheter and this was the thing, you could swap out the Foley catheter and put another one in and see if that would happen as well, which would be a pretty unconventional thing to do during cardiac arrest. If you hopped in the back of a truck and saw a paramedic putting a Foley catheter instead of an ET tube, you might look at them weird, but that probably would have been more beneficial for this guy. But like big things we do, what your best ion shifter for potassium is going to be insulin. So look for hypoglycemia and try to treat that as well. There's plenty of times that it sounds counterintuitive. It did to me too, that you're giving insulin and dextrose at the same time for this, but you don't care. You want the sugar to be normal. You're just trying to shift the potassium to temporize that measure. Again, these are temporizing things. Ultimately, you're going to need dialysis at the end of the day.
Right. And I think you hit the nail on the head there is these patients might present hypoglycemic because our bodies are trying to utilize the insulin that we do have to stabilize our potassium levels. And when you go through the in-hospital treatment of hyperkalemia, you look in one arm and they're running IV insulin, and you look in the left arm and they're running dextrose. And it's like, man, this is kind of funky, right? This is really weird. But when we think about the pathophysiology, it starts to make a lot of sense. So we also talked about getting an advanced airway on these patients, making sure that we can get the acidosis out. And I think that's the next point that you saw in this case. And I think that this is such a unique case because you were able to go through the steps and measurements of a hyperkalemic patient from start, from peri-arrest to arrest. You got ROSC on this patient. You swapped the Foley out. What happened? Talk about relieving some of that acidosis. What are the ways we can go about it?
Yeah. So bicarb's very loaded, just kind of overall in the literature. I would still say you should not be giving bicarb routinely in cardiac arrest. It doesn't really do anything. At the end of the day, all you're really doing is shifting ions to. In this case, it was more used for getting potassium potentially into the cell itself, and didn't know how truly acidotic this patient was at the end of the day. You had a little bit more clinical picture in comparison to showing up on scene for the unknown downtime or the quote witnessed arrest that was down and someone's trying to give bicarb to at the end of the day. Ventilations are going to be your key at the end of the day to really do that. Your best fix to try to fix an acidosis is going to be through ventilation, and we have all of those tools readily at our hands to kind of go through and do. Even if you don't have an ET tube in or a supraglottic airway, try to throw that end-tidal CO2 on your BVM. We're terrible about it in the hospital. I think this is one thing that we can really kind of pull ahead a lot further in the pre-hospital environment by being the pioneers for that. If your end-tidal is not good, your seal is probably not good, right? So try to get that two-person technique in. It's amazing how much you can truly improve your ventilations with that. It's still probably one of the biggest things I see in cardiac arrest, just showing up on scenes with people, is just we suck at ventilating patients still. And we think we're up there at the head squeezing this bag, so we're doing the thing, but it's not actually really doing anything at the end of the day. And that's going to be probably your biggest bang for your buck as far as correcting acidosis too. Another thing I comment too on is calcium in general. So I don't want you to get from this talk that like everybody needs to get calcium. There's actually been some fairly large randomized control trial studies. One of them they actually stopped early because there was detrimental outcomes to patients who were just getting routine administrations of calcium. In that study itself, they excluded anybody who they thought had renal pathology for it, because that's the reasoning for it. But just routine administration of calcium actually showed detriment in your rate of ROSC and overall neurologic outcome as well. So if you have the good clinical reason for it, yeah, go ahead and do it. And just remember too, if you're giving calcium and bicarb, make sure that line's flushed really well, or you have a second line, because you don't want to precipitate and lose your only line too at the end of the day.
They do talk about that in paramedic school, maybe not as hard as they should, but knowing our general chemistry, calcium bicarbonate, not something you really want in your arm. I mean, your patient's going to suffer, and you're going to feel like not a nice fellow when you're doing that, and create some negative things. So when we talk about correcting acidosis in the pre-hospital setting, we talked about getting that advanced airway, improving that minute ventilation, getting some of that carbon dioxide out. We did talk about in this patient that there was a Foley. You sort of foreshadowed it earlier by saying if you would have swapped this Foley in the back of the ambulance, would have done more. So they have a suprapubic mass. We swapped the Foley in the hospital, and 2.5 liters of urine come out. That's another pretty pertinent finding when we're thinking about correcting acidosis. So when we see this in the pre-hospital or hospital setting, why is that important?
So it's a lot that just drained from your Foley catheter in general. You got to be concerned about this too, because you can get hypotension from this as well. Now you've just drained this entire obstruction, and your kidneys are hopefully going to perk up a little bit and start making some urine. So it's going to be a lot of changes to the body in general, that my beans were asleep and now they're finally awake, kind of doing things. I'd still would hydrate the crap out of this guy with additional IV fluids itself. You can get into the conflict of that with, do you do normal saline versus lactated ringers as well? So you're going to see people argue. You might even hear some nephrologists say that lactated ringers should not be used because there's potassium in it itself. So normal body physiology for potassium, you're somewhere between 3.5 to 4.5. It's going to be your normal based off whatever text you're reading. Lactated ringers itself is, quote, considered more physiologic because it has 4 mL equivalents per liter of potassium in it as well. Saline has none. If you look at pH of saline, it's about 5.5 versus pH of lactated ringers is 6. So both are still acidotic-y fluids, but the lactated ringer is going to be less acidotic. You also have the lactate part, which gets converted into bicarbonate as well. That might help with the beans as well, kind of keeping things going. So it's fine to use lactated ringers at this point, right? Even with this potassium being high, say your potassium here in this case was 8.8, you're giving a fluid that has 4 milliequivalents per liter of potassium. So it's still lower, and it's down to that more physiologic thing. So you're still essentially diluting out some of that potassium and going to be lowering it too. In this case, it's probably a better balanced fluid for you to pick over saline, which if you're aggressively volume resuscitating with saline, you can get that hyperchloremic acidosis as well. That's going to show up later down the road with this patient. And this guy who's going to get dialysis, you can end up correcting all that yourself with a dialysis machine all fancily, but someone who's kind of on that cusp of needing dialysis versus not down the road with...
Right. So I think another great point is understanding the why and how behind things. We actually talked about in our last or two episodes ago the difference between saline and LR, debunked some of the myths that LR actually pretty good for our patients who are hyperkalemic, better than saline. We've seen a lot of really good RCTs that show that saline exacerbates some acidosis. But we talk about it all the time on this podcast is using the tools that you have in your toolbox. You might be at a service that does not carry LR, and that does not mean to not give fluid resuscitation to this patient. It 1,000% means it. And I think that brings me to my next point. So we sort of beat this case in. We saw it from all the different angles. We talked about this patient getting ROSC. I want to revisit an important point in this case, and that's when they become hypotensive and they are peri-arrest. They are... you're about to intubate. We always talk about resuscitating before we intubate. We don't want to create more hypoxia or hypotension when we think about like dash 1A intubations. We start talking a lot about that more pertinently in the field. How do we address the hypotension in this patient? I think the one really nice thing is we're starting to see Levofed roll back out here in Pennsylvania. Some services don't carry any pressors. Some carry dopamine. You went with some push-dose epi. Epidrip, maybe not a terrible idea. Like I said, always starting with a good fluid challenge. You went saline through the IO because that's what you had in your box at the time. If you carry dopamine, what are your thoughts on it in a renal patient? And what are your thoughts on correcting hypotension in your peri-arrest patient prior to your intubation?
Yeah, I'd say you need to be aggressive before you intubate. As long as there's nothing where you're like, I need to put the tube in right now or they're going to die because they're exsanguinating from their mouth, something like that. You're not able to get decent ventilations in itself. But if you have that time to take the extra 5-10 minutes to really volume resuscitate and kind of maximize your things, that's what you should be doing every time with your intubations. I do this all the time in the ER. I will do it in the field as well. As far as dopamine or dobutamine, I personal opinion, we should just take those all off the trucks in general. Every study that's out there is saying Levofed, norepinephrine, that's your main vasopressor of choice for just about everything you're going to do. If I had norepinephrine at that point, I probably would have done a push of that and or started on a drip with it. There's plenty of times where even I will know that the patient is volume down, say it's septic shock or something, and they're going to require intubation in the hospital environment. As I'm giving IV fluids, I still put them on the norepinephrine. You have something in the tank to squeeze, and you know you're going to continue to volume resuscitate them, but you want to make sure your hemodynamics are appropriate as possible before you're going to induce them with some type of sedative and paralytic. My kind of go-to with everything, I really like ketamine. Ketamine's always been my favorite at the end of the day, unless there's really concerns for that severe head injury, which a lot of that stuff's kind of debunked as well. So kind of like my general approach to the stuff in the field with this is I don't have all the extra tools that I have in the hospital itself as well. So I normally, instead of just doing a true RSI where you push your sedative and paralytic, I'll try with just the sedative itself, kind of like how you would do for a sedation-assisted intubation. Take a look. If I can get it with that, then I just do it with that. If I'm running into trouble or there's a clenched jaw, then I'll push the paralytic too. But that at least gives me a look where I can look and go, oh, okay, I'll be able to get this, or oh crap, this is really bad. I'm glad I didn't push the paralytic and had them arrest too.
I think you hit a lot of great points there, and I'm over here in my chair cheering when you said we got to throw out dobutamine or dopamine. I think one thing that we have to consider is not all pressors are the same. We talked about this again in a past episode, but dopamine is going to cause some renal vasoconstriction, especially at the doses that are recommended for our pre-hospital providers. So again, not a great pressor overall, but especially if we're thinking about renal impaired patients, not the right thing to do. So going with Levofed, neo pushes, if you carry phenylephrine in the field, not a bad idea as well, but making sure we have something in the tank before we intubate. And I think one of the most important points that you just mentioned was we hear rapid sequence intubation. And I think it's really important to reiterate that is anything but rapid. It is not something that we are, you know, if you are a layman and you hear RSI and rapid sequence intubation, it's not bang, boom, throw the tube in. It's a very controlled thing, or it should be. And so that's going to lead me to one of our final points here is how do you go about properly intubating these patients so that we don't exacerbate some of the findings and cause more harm in cardiac arrest? Because we often think about it, oh, you know, my patient's in arrest, can't get much worse than dead. But they certainly can. Even not addressing some of the things that you're finding in the pre-hospital setting, you might prevent ROSC. And our goal should be to get ROSC on our patients that have the ability to be resuscitated. A witnessed cardiac arrest is a great example of that. And we saw it in this case. You got ROSC because we're appropriately managing our patient. What are some of the safest findings that we can do as paramedics to facilitate good intubations, good outcomes, and just good practice in the field?
I'd say point number one, positioning. Just take that extra 10, 15, even 30 seconds, however long it takes you to truly make sure you're maximizing your axes to line up so you can really maximize that first pass success rate with it. In the moment, you feel like you just have to like stick the blade in and get the tube in, but you're doing yourself a disservice by not taking that extra time to really maximize your first pass success attempt with it. I think that's your first thing. Number two point would be put your pride away. I still struggle with that at times when you stick the blade in and you're trying to fish around, and then you're like, it's been a minute and we haven't oxygenated this patient or provided any type of ventilation. So you're getting hypoxic and you're getting hypercapnic, and that's also not going to help your hemodynamics as well, because you can be giving all the vasopressors you want in the world, but once you get to a certain point with acidosis, your vasopressors aren't going to do anything. The only one you really have that potentially will do anything would be vasopressin. That one's really not pH dependent, but again, who has vasopressin on their truck?
Right, is we need to manage our patients the best way that we can. Putting the pride aside, my mentor had told me whenever I make an intubation attempt, it sounds a little bit weird, I hold my breath. He did the same thing. That's how he was taught. He's like, I always hold my breath. When I can't breathe, the patient most certainly can't breathe. And that's when it's time to put the pride aside. You know, give yourself 20, 30 seconds, hold your breath. If you're starting to become a little short of breath, your patient's probably really suffering. So it's time to pull out the blade. Again, with what you said, bagging our patients appropriately, either the two thumbs down method, but really two person bagging is phenomenal. Typically on a cardiac arrest in the pre-hospital setting, you've got a lot of hands, whether it be your partner, maybe a chase medic, fire department, typically police are now coming out on more arrests. You've got a lot of hands, and it's well within your scope of practice to delegate tasks and coach. As a paramedic, I should be able to look at a layperson and say, this is where I want you to put your hands. This is how I want you to squeeze a bag. And this is how often I want you to do it. Count the six, squeeze the bag this hard, right? We're not squeezing the full volume in our patients, hopefully, but it's not the hardest thing to do. So when we think about that, how do we go about managing those patients? So we get the tube in and now we're starting to bag. Let's close this case out as a whole. So once you get that tube, we talked about what you did in this case. How do you go about managing your patient that's intubated, in arrest, or in this case, I think something that's really pertinent in EMS is how do you manage a complex ROSC patient?
I would say as far as your Ross patient that you're having trouble with, or the one that you keep kind of losing pulses on again? You have that like brief Ross. It's what's getting you that Ross at the end of the day? Was there anything different from this first one compared to the second one that you did or didn't? Are your hemodynamics changing because of something? And you have a lot of tools to look at itself as far as your end tidal capnography, if that's jumping up, what your blood pressure is. There's a patient, it wasn't this patient that I had, that we were not getting blood pressures at all on the NIBP, even manual ones people were having trouble with. And I was literally just titrating blood pressures based off how strong the femoral pulse felt at one point, doing these ridiculous high doses of epinephrine. This code was like an hour and a half. It was just like ROSC, then back, then ROSC, then back. And finally, I got the right concoction of the appropriate amount of vasopressors to go. And as you're ventilating and whatnot, fixing that acidosis, those vasopressors are going to act better too at the end of the day with it. I think the important thing is, if you're not moving, like when you first get ROSCs, the first thing everybody wants to do is just pick them up and throw them in the back of the truck and go to the hospital because you've got ROSC. Just stop. Don't do that. There's so much physiology and pathophysiology that just changed in that body once that heart started to contract on its own. So let them stay on the ground for a bit. Get your 12-lead EKG, check your vital signs, check your glucose, recheck your tube, go from your head-to-toe assessment again, and try to make sure that you're doing everything. That first period there, as soon as you get post-ROS, remember, you just have a ton of epinephrine that's floating around. It's going to get chewed up itself. So aggressive blood pressure management is probably one of your most important things at that point, and frequently checking them.
I just want to re-hammer the fact, please, please, work your arrests on scene. Work your ROSC patient right there in the spot. We talk about it, you know, all the time. We don't transport cardiac arrest patients, or we should not be transporting. I don't want to say we don't, because, you know, maybe you are, and I want to say that that is wrong. We should be managing that arrest pre-hospitally. We have a ton of tools in our box to manage cardiac arrest patients, but we also have tools to manage our patients that are freshly resuscitated and in ROSC, and moving those patients, moving everything that we just accomplished around could very much be detrimental to our patients. So Matt, to close out here, we hit this case from head to toe. We looked at it from all angles. What are some key takeaways that you had looking back on this case the first few times, and then looking back on it again now? What do you want to tell the paramedics in the field that you wish you knew, they should be aware of and looking at differently, and managing these really complex patients?
I would say it's really easy to get stuck in that they're in cardiac arrest, I'm just going to follow ACLS and just kind of stop it there and just be paying attention to ABCs. I mean, in the beginning, yeah, make sure you're doing your compressions, make sure someone's doing your airway management, getting your IV access, et cetera, but kind of step back and take a look at the bigger picture, right? Like if I didn't take the clothes off and see the Foley catheter and like the suprapubic area being full and there's really not much urine in the Foley catheter, I would have missed the entire boat on this and not put the pieces of the picture together. Like, yeah, the 12 lead looked abnormal, but I was kind of looking at that as, is there some type of like cardiac thing causing this itself? It didn't really strike me exactly as hyperkalemia the first time looking at it until I saw the next one. But if I didn't have all those pieces of the puzzle together with it, I don't know if I would have done the same thing, right? It's hard to say, kind of looking back, hindsight 2020 with it, but take a step back and think about it. We think about the H's and T's, and there's not much we can fix in the field at times, we feel like, but how do you approach those, and what things can you find itself to really fix? Just kind of take that step back, and you'd be amazed at what you see sometimes.
Yeah, I think the last thing that I want to ask you involves directly what you just said. So you have a ton of experience that we talked about on a prior episode, and being an EMT, a medic, going to med school, now being a physician, a lot of education, but a lot of time with patients, and more importantly, a lot of time assessing patients. What would you say to a new paramedic, and this really goes for clinicians at any level, nurses, EMTs, EMRs, still physicians, nothing beats a good, clean, thorough assessment, and I think you would agree with that. What's the best way to go about it?
I would say, number one, don't think every patient's bullshit. It's very easy to get stuck in that mindset that This isn't the cool thing that I want to go to, and it's bullshit. You'll get caught with your pants down way too many times than not. And the bigger thing, too, I think, is the more you learn, the more stuff you see. Try to get the follow-up on the patients if you can. If you work in a hospital system where you readily have access to the EMR, it's probably going to be easier for you to get follow-up. But even on those patients that you think are, quote, bullshit, look to see what the diagnosis was at the end of the day. Yeah, it's going to be sometimes with it, but always assume there's pathology there at some point and go from there. And then the more pathophysiology things you learn and how this presents, and you've seen this patient present like that, especially in that follow-up, then the next time you're on the next call, you can be like, wait, this, and this thing are happening. I think I've seen this before. This makes sense concerning for this. And you'd be amazed at how much more you're getting the correct diagnosis, or at least top 3-4 differentials are going to be correct that you're thinking of.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that the weight of a good, clean, thorough assessment does wonders. And it's something that we often write off in the field. I'm just as vulnerable as the next person of, especially because I work in a city environment often, going up and being like, ah, you know, you get called out for the class one bullshit. And it's really easy to be like, all right, you look at your EMT and you're like, all you, man. And the next thing you know, your EMT's popping their head up through the cabinet window and they're like, hey, their heart rate's, you know, 220 or 40. And you're like, man, I probably shouldn't have wrote that one off, huh? And then now you've... All right, put them on the 3-lead, you go back. So nothing beats that initial assessment at any level, but making sure it's good, clean, and thorough. And I think that you really hit that point well. So Matt, we looked at this case, we looked at a lot of different things. Is there anything that you would change that you would have done differently looking back on it?
Yeah, I think from the EMT level, if you were starting off with this, kind of BLS stuff, just focus on your good BLS care. I mean, try to do an assessment as well to look. If you saw the Foley catheter and the suprapubic region being weird, it might not necessarily click for you at that point, but it's something when your ALS shows up or you would get to the hospital if you didn't have any ALS that you could at least report and be like, this is weird. And that might key somebody into some things. As far as on the ALS side of things, I mean, again, kind of going back to that assessment on it, at least kind of taking the step back and looking at the bigger picture of things. I think if there's something I wish I would have done differently with it, would have been given calcium earlier with it. That may have prevented the arrest itself. But at that point in time, I didn't really have all the pieces together. Focusing on some lower blood pressures now, trying to maximize that. But don't be afraid to call in and talk about things with it. It all depends what command doctor you get. Some of us, not all command docs are created equally. Some of us are a little bit more willing to do things than not. But if you can plead a good case for it and provide some good information, then I think it's reasonable to try to do and go for it.
Matt, I think that, again, you've hit some really amazing points with this. And it's always awesome for me to have guests on this podcast that provide new perspectives. When you sent me this case study to take a look at, I was so beyond excited. You start to look at some really cool things, especially when you've been working in EMS for a while. You see a lot of patients that... you know, more often than not, they might not be at the peri-arrest level, but you're like, man, some peak T waves, maybe a little wider QRS, especially now that we're starting, you know, if depending on the charting system you use, you might get the hospitals to put in their outcome and you can go in from your computer and say, oh man, this patient was hyperkalemic. That's the admitting diagnosis. And you're like, I sort of suspected that. So I think that that's really cool. And so I was so excited when I saw this case study and we talked about it. So I really want to thank you for coming on another episode here, talking about this case and breaking it down with us, because there's some big impacts that we can do as paramedics. And like you said, looking back on it, maybe you give the calcium earlier. Again, we're managing a number of things in the pre-hospital setting all at once, it feels like. So it's hard to do that in the moment. But that's why this podcast and other podcasts and even literature is really important, because your practices might change just based off the education that you continue to seek out. So I really want to thank you for coming on here and talking to us more about this case and really a lot of different things throughout the case. So Matt, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. It's a good time.
Yeah, this is awesome. It's a real treat to be able to talk about this and see things like that. So we really appreciate you coming out. Anything you want to leave us with?
Always strive to be better. We It can always be better. Don't beat yourself up if you miss something, though, too, at the end of the day. We're all learning. We're always learning. I learn something new every day. And just keep trucking along.
Can't close it better than that, Matt. Thanks for coming out. Been a real pleasure.
Thanks.